David wrinkled his forehead. He was trying to figure out where the king was taking this. "Well," he began, "I say, of course, because my child's friends have such an effect on her, and I mean both good and bad. We've noticed that when she is around good, respectful children, we rarely have a problem with her behavior. But occasionally she'll mix in with the wrong group at school, and her mother and I have to deal with the consequences at home."
"Consequences?" Solomon asked.
"Her speech patterns, her attitude, the way she dresses, how she responds to us." David struggled to find the right words. "Everything she does at her age seems to be influenced by someone else."
"How do you guide the direction in which your daughter changes?" Solomon asked.
"By keeping tabs on who her friends are," David said.
"Exactly," the king said excitedly. "And at what age are we no longer affected by those around us? 18? 21? 30? Of course, the answer is we are always and forever influenced by those with whom we associate. If a man keeps company with those who curse and complain, he will soon find curses and complaints flowing like a river from his own mouth. If he spends his days with the lazy, those seeking handouts, he will soon find his finances in disarray. Many of our sorrows can be traced to relationships with the wrong people."
David got to his feet. Wiping his hands on his jeans, he said, "So this is an important step in seeking wisdom?"
"Possibly the most important step," Solomon responded. "Guard your associations carefully, David. Any time you tolerate mediocrity in your choice of companions, you become more comfortable with mediocrity in your own life. If a lazy man isn't an irritation to you, it is a sign you have accepted slothfulness as a way of life. You saw Ahishar as you entered, did you not?"
"Yes," David nodded. "I believe you said he was the prime minister."
"That is correct," the king acknowledged. "You have not met Zadok, Azariah, and Abiathar. They are my priest. Eliorif and Ahijah are my personal assistants. Jehoshaphat is in charge of government records, and Benaiah is my army commander. All are wise and energetic men with whom I keep counsel. If it is important for a king to be careful in his choice of friends, would it not also be important for you?"
David walked to one of the gold shields on the wall and stroked it absent-mindedly. "You are the wisest man in the world," he said, "and obviously the richest. Yet you said you keep counsel with those other men? Why?"
Solomon smiled patiently. "Only a fool refuses the counsel of wise men. There is safety in counsel. Sensible instruction is a life-giving fountain that will help you escape all manner of deadly traps. Find a wise man, a person who has accomplished what you wish for in your own life, and listen closely to his words."
Solomon moved to the table and picked up the scroll. Placing it into a fold of his robe, he motioned to David. "Follow me," he said. As Solomon exited the interior room, he held the curtain open for David to pass. David stepped under Solomon's arm and said, "I should be holding the curtain for you. After all, you are the king." Solomon laughed.
"Thank you, but I appreciate the opportunity to serve you. When a king begins to act like a king, it is not long before someone else is king. Serving is a way we can place value on one another. A wise man is a server."
As they strode into the great hall, David indicated the throne and said, "May I touch it?"
"Certainly," Solomon replied. "You may sit in it if you wish. It is only a chair."
David placed his hands palm down on the throne. Lightly brushing the seat and armrest with his fingertips, he admired the placement of the ivory and gold. Turning, he eased himself onto the throne. Smiling sheepishly, he said, "I feel very small sitting here."
"As do I," Solomon chuckled.
Then seriously, he said, "The responsibility that comes with leadership is often humbling. When I sit where you are now, I am grateful for the lessons of my father. As you might know, his name was also David. He was not only the king before me, but my mentor as well." Solomon gazed out at the empty hall, seemingly lost in thought. Continuing, he said, "My father has been dead now for many years, yet the fundamentals he taught guide me still." Solomon removed the scroll from his garment and unrolled the skin from the wooden rod. As he passed the precious words to David, he said, "It is time for us to part, my friend. Perhaps our time together will bring more understanding to your life's journey. I can do nothing to alleviate your struggles, and would not if I were able. It is never the duty of a leader to struggle for someone else. A leader must encourage others to struggle and assure them that their struggles are worthwhile. Do battle with the challenges of your present, and you will unlock the prizes of your future." "Thank you, Your Majesty," David said. "Of course," Solomon replied. He smiled as he bowed slightly. "It has been an honor to assist you. Farewell." With those final words, the king walked down the steps and directly through the middle of the vast hall. As he neared the doorway at the opposite end, he clapped his hands twice. Immediately, attendants appeared to flank the king as he left the building. Alone, David stood up and looked once more at the magnificent room. Slowly, he slid back onto the throne of King Solomon and smoothed the king's words onto his lap. The second decision for success. I will seek wisdom. Knowing that wisdom waits to be gathered, I will actively search her out. My past can never be changed, but I can change the future by changing my actions today. I will change my actions today. I will train my eyes and ears to read and listen to books and recordings that bring about positive changes in my personal relationships and a greater understanding of my fellow man. No longer will I bombard my mind with materials that feed my doubts and fears. I will read and listen only to what increases my belief in myself and my future. I will seek wisdom. I will choose my friends with care. I am who my friends are. I speak their language and I wear their clothes. I share their opinions and their habits. From this moment forward, I will choose to associate with people whose lives and lifestyles I admire. If I associate with chickens, I will learn to scratch at the ground and squabble over crumbs. If I associate with eagles, I will learn to soar to great heights. I am an eagle. It is my destiny to fly. I will seek wisdom. I will listen to the counsel of wise men. The words of a wise man are like raindrops on dry ground. They are precious and can be quickly used for immediate results. Only the blade of grass that catches a raindrop will prosper and grow. The person who ignores wise counsel is like the blade of grass untouched by the rain, soon to wither and die. When I counsel with just myself, I can make decisions only according to what I already know. By counseling with a wise man, I add his knowledge and experience to my own and dramatically increase my success. I will seek wisdom. I will be a servant to others. A wise man will cultivate a servant spirit. For that particular attribute attracts people like no other. As I humbly serve others, their wisdom will be freely shared with me. Often, the person who develops a servant spirit becomes wealthy beyond measure. Many times, a servant has the ear of the king, and a humble servant often becomes a king, for he is the popular choice of the people. He who serves the most grows the fastest. I will become a humble servant. I will not look for someone to open my door. I will look to open the door for someone. I will not be distressed when no one is available to help me. I will be excited when I am available to help. I will be a servant to others. I will listen to the counsel of wise men. I will choose my friends with care. I will seek wisdom. Chapter 5. I will seek wisdom. The last words. This time David was ready. In anticipation of the dizziness he had felt before, he closed his eyes and tensed his whole body. David could feel the skin of the scroll in his left hand as he gripped it against the armrest of the throne. He was holding on for dear life, and for a moment nothing happened. Just as David was about to relax, he opened his eyes to see his fingers literally sliding through the ivory as if it were air. The scroll was still in his possession, and David's hands, holding so tightly to a solid object only a moment before, reflexively made fists as the throne disappeared. The next conscious moment, David was standing amid the loudest noise he had ever heard in his life. His first thought as he tried to regain his senses was thunder, and he looked toward the sky. Suddenly, a hand roughly slammed into his chest, grabbed his shirt, and forcefully yanked David to the ground. "Get down, man," the owner of the hand said as he pushed David's face to the dirt. "I don't know if you can get shot, but let's not find out, okay?" David turned his head in panic and stared at the man who had pulled him down. He was somewhere in his mid-30s with dark brown hair and a long, bushy mustache. He wore dark blue trousers with a faded yellow stripe down the side and a shirt of indeterminate color. The clothes, like their owner, looked as if they had not been washed in a month. He was rather thin and probably tall. It was hard to tell because he was laid out on the ground firing an old rifle over a pile of rocks. The sound David had mistaken for thunder moments earlier was the sound of cannon fire. Bullets whined off the rocks like swarms of angry bees. All around him, David heard howls of anger and pain. A man not 10 feet away sat propped against a tree, shrieking in agony from a wound in his stomach, while another, missing his right leg below the knee, slowly crawled toward a friend who was already dead. The cannonballs that weren't pounding groups of men found trees nearby, severing trunks as big around as the soldiers on whom they fell. It was so loud that David had to scream to be heard. That was not a problem. In fact, at the moment, it was the most natural thing in the world. He was terrified. David grabbed at the man's shoulder and cried, "Who are you?" The man had turned his back to the rocks where he was reloading his rifle from the muzzle. "Chamberlain," he yelled. "Chamberlain of the 20th Maine!" And he turned to fire again. Once again, the man called Chamberlain turned to reload. He lay awkwardly on his side as he bit the paper from around and rammed it down the barrel of the gun with a metal rod. "What's going on?" David hollered. "Where are we?" David had never been so scared in his life. "Stay down!" Chamberlain yelled in reply. "No time now! We'll talk later, I hope." David anxiously glanced around. He could see that the rocks they were crouched behind had actually been thrown up as a makeshift wall, extending more than 50 yards to his right and 50 yards again to his left. They were almost at the top of a steep wooded hill that sloped down and away from them. Chamberlain continued to fire downhill, reload, and shout encouragement to the men around him. Just beyond Chamberlain, David saw a man thrown backward, his blood arcing into the air from a wound in his throat. He landed on his hands and knees. Slowly shaking his head, he crawled toward David. Reaching the wall, he eased over onto his back, and as his arm fell across David's leg, he looked up, smiled, and died. As David stared into the unseeing eyes, he was horrified to realize that the soldier was a boy, certainly no older than 15. David wasn't aware of the precise moment when the shooting stopped. He had remained huddled against the rocks, looking into the dead boy's face, until Chamberlain's hand broke his trance. The man gently brushed the young soldier's eyes, closing them, and said, "Nielsen, he was a good kid." He gestured to a man, obviously dead, lying across the rock wall no more than 10 yards away. That was his father. Hiram was a bank teller from Bangor. Both joined when this regiment was formed last fall. There were 1,000 of us then. The 300 that are left are strung out along this pile of rocks." Chamberlain stood up and offered his hand to David. Helping him to his feet, he said, "I'm Colonel Chamberlain, Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain. I know why you're here, but I don't know your name."
"I'm David Ponder, sir. Is it safe to be standing up like this?"
"For the moment," Chamberlain replied as he pulled a small twig from his mustache. "But they'll sure be back. That was the fourth time they've made a try for us already."
"If you don't mind me asking," David stammered, "who are they?"
The colonel cocked his head and frowned.
"Why, Lee's boys, the Army of Northern Virginia. We have fully half the Confederate battle complement facing off against us in a long line that stretches to a little town about a mile that way."
Chamberlain pointed with his rifle.
"What's the name of the town?" David asked.
"Gettysburg," Chamberlain offered. "Ever hear of it?"
David nodded his head as a cold boiling began deep in his stomach.
"The Civil War," he whispered.
"What?"
Chamberlain asked.
"I said this is the Civil War." Chamberlain snorted. "That may be what you call it. Stick around for a bit. I can assure you there's nothing civil about it.
"Come with me," he said, beginning to walk. "We won't have much time until they hit us again."
"Joshua!"
The two men turned at the shout.
"Joshua!"
It was Tom and John Chamberlain, the colonel's younger brothers. Tom was a lieutenant in the regiment, while John, a muscular young man, had been pressed into service as a medic. Both were almost as tall as the colonel and wore mustaches and sideburns that almost covered their faces. They were endowed with a cheerfulness, however, that their older brother had long since discarded.
"You're a little dirtier than you ought to be, Joshua, but you're looking well. Are you all right?"
John asked.
"Yes. Fine to this point. You?" "So far, so good,"
John said. David followed the three brothers as they walked quickly along the wall.
"Sergeant Tozier was hit, but not seriously. His section took some heavy losses, though." "How are we doing, Colonel?"
The question came from a man of about 50. He had a bandage around his head and was busily making a wounded friend comfortable.
"You're giving it to him, soldier," Chamberlain said. "Keep pouring it on."
Turning to his brothers, he instructed,
"John, get over the hill and find a place for the wounded. Tom, go to the rear of the regiment and see that it is well closed up, and tell the men to thin their lines. Stretch at least half the men to the left of that big rock. The Rebs are working that way, and if they flank us..."
Chamberlain's voice trailed away.
"Well," he continued, "they just can't flank us, that's all."
They turned to move away when their older brother stopped them again.
"Boys," he said, "I don't like this. Keep your head down. With all of us here, it could be a bad day for Mother."
As his brothers ran off, Chamberlain turned to David and motioned for him to follow. They picked their way through the broken trees and tumbled sections of the wall, stepping over the men who were preparing to fight again and the ones who would fight no more. The colonel climbed onto the big rock he had indicated earlier to his brother and helped David up beside him.
"You can see them from here," he said.
David squinted through the smoke that still lay thick in the air. Following Chamberlain's gaze, he saw the gray and pale yellow uniforms of the Confederate Army massing below. They were less than 150 yards away. David could see their hats and the occasional face looking up the hill.
"Who are you?" David asked.
Chamberlain had been peering intently down the hill. But at this question, he jerked his head sharply back toward his visitor.
"What? I've already told you. My name is..."
"That's not what I mean," David interrupted. "I mean, who are you? No offense, but are you famous? The other places I appeared, it was to see someone, well, famous." Chamberlain laughed. It was a quick, dry laugh devoid of humor.
"Famous? 10 months ago, I was a school teacher. Now I'm a soldier. For a while, anyway. Actually, it was about the time I joined up that I started dreaming about you. I knew what you looked like, how tall you were."
The colonel tugged at David's sleeve.
"I even knew you'd be wearing this. I've never had dreams like these before. Strange. Constant. Every night for months. You want to hear something spooky? Just before you arrived, there in the middle of the fight, I looked up and raised my hand. You appeared. I closed my fist on your shirt and pulled you down. When I raised my hand to grab you, I knew you'd be there. It was just like in my dreams."
"Why are you here?" David asked. Chamberlain eyed him curiously.
"Do you mean the war in general or this specific desolate hill?"
"Both, I suppose." Chamberlain stroked his beard.
"I joined the Union Army for a myriad of reasons. Same as everyone else, really. We got caught up in the patriotism. We were bored. We were ashamed not to join. We thought it'd be quick and fun. For the most part, though, I think the vast majority of our men left their homes and families because it was the right thing to do."
Chamberlain was quiet for a moment, distracted by the men forming behind fallen trees as they spread out their line.
"Colonel!"
one of the men yelled.
"The brush is too thick here. We can't see 30 yards. "Dig in and stay where you are, son," Chamberlain yelled back. "They'll be a lot closer than that."
After a few moments of silence, David prompted Chamberlain. "Colonel," he started, "you said you joined because it was the right thing to do?"
"Yes," Chamberlain continued. "Over the centuries, wars have been fought for land or women or money.
Thousands of people have died in battles caused by jealousy or an insult. More than a few times, men have fought because a king or a president or someone told them to fight. Chamberlain turned squarely to face David and looked him in the eye. David Ponder, I say to you now that this is the first time in history that men fought to set another man free. Most of us Maine boys never even seen the black skin on a man. But if it is true that all men are created equal, then we're fighting for each other. We're fighting because it's the right thing to do. The colonel held David's eyes for a long moment, then slowly turned to look up the line of men. I'm not certain anymore just what I expected when I signed on for this fight. But it wasn't this. He lowered himself into a squatting position, balancing easily on the balls of his feet. Picking absently at a weed that had grown through the rock, Chamberlain said, I was at Fredericksburg, you know. It wasn't a question. It was a statement. 3,000 of us attacked a rock wall, just like this one. We came across a field as the sun was setting. From about 50, 60 yards, they fired. We dropped in waves, literally sheets of men falling like a curtain on a bad play. The attack failed, but I made it to the wall. I lay there all night, too scared to withdraw. Cold. I burrowed down into the corpses for warmth, listening to our men shoot back. I'll never forget the sound a bullet makes when it hits a dead body. It's altogether different from the sound of a bullet in living flesh. Chamberlain shook his head forcefully, as if to drive the memory away. Oh, well, he said as he stood up. He had pulled a weed from the rock and used it as a sword, pointing again toward the wall. That'll never happen here. This wall won't turn them much longer. We don't have enough men left. He threw the weed to the ground. I have a feeling, he said, that if we lose this fight, the war will be over. David stepped up beside the colonel. Why did you choose this place to defend? I didn't choose it, Chamberlain said dryly. Colonel Vincent placed me here this morning. Why did he place you here? David pressed. Well, we are the extreme left of the Union Army. The 83rd Pennsylvania is formed on our right, but to our left, nothing. We're the end of a line that runs from here all the way back to Gettysburg. That means I cannot withdraw. If the Confederate Army flanks us, if the Rebs overrun us, they'll come in behind our cannons and barricades, and the Army of the Potomac will be forfeit. 80,000 men caught from the back on a downhill charge with no protection. And if it happens, it will have come through me. At that very second, David heard a ghostly sound resonate from down the hill. Rising to a high, thin pitch, 1,000 voices strained in a long, continuous scream. It was the rebel yell. They were coming. David caught glimpses of the soldiers through the trees as they ran up the steep hill. Chamberlain had turned to direct David off the rock when the cannon shell hit. Striking the base of the rock on which they were standing, the projectile threw both men into the air. As he hit the ground, David felt as though a giant vacuum had sucked all the air from his body. Before he could check to see if he'd been injured, before he could even breathe, Chamberlain had him by the arm, dragging him to the protection of the wall. Only the cannons were firing now, David realized, as he struggled to get his lungs working again. He could still hear the blood-curdling yells as the rebels worked their way up the hill. He rolled over onto his knees and glanced over the wall. They were within sight. It seemed to David as though the Confederate Army was about to step into his lap. Shoot, he thought. For God's sake, shoot! They're right here! It seemed an eternity, but finally David heard Chamberlain call out, Hit him! A long, rolling crack of rifle fire rang out. It began near David and ran like a fuse up the line to the right. Scores of rebels fell on the first volley. They were more careful after that, using trees to shield them from the deadly fire, but still they came. The firing was continuous now. To David it sounded like thunder and firecrackers thrown into an earthquake. The man next to him grunted and fell backward, his head and face a bloody mess.
To David's astonishment, the man sat up, pulled a handkerchief from his pocket, and wrapped the cloth around his head. Wiping the blood from his eyes with a sleeve, he picked up his rifle and began loading it to fire again. Chamberlain was directing his men now and had moved some distance from David. All down the line, a few of the rebels had reached the wall. Most of the shooting was point blank. The colonel had drawn his pistol, and David watched as Chamberlain and a rebel, no more than 3 feet apart, aimed guns at each other. The Confederate soldier went down in a cloud of red mist. Chamberlain continued to fire at targets all around him until, without warning, the rebels pulled back. As suddenly as they had appeared, they withdrew. Chamberlain's men cautiously stood up to take stock of their situation. David walked quickly toward the colonel, who was walking away from him. The rock wall on his left side as he walked was draped with the bodies of blue and gray. He passed a man who was crying and cursing as he held a younger man in his arms. Jogging as he caught up with Chamberlain, David reached out and touched his shoulder. "Colonel," he said. Chamberlain stopped, staring straight ahead. "Colonel, I know you're very busy and I don't want to bother you, but why am I here?" Chamberlain slowly shook his head. "I don't know. I only knew that you would come." "There is something I'm to learn from you," David pleaded. "I'm sure of it. Think, what could it be?" The colonel smiled slightly and raised his eyebrows. Turning to David, he said, "I'm a professor of rhetoric. I am fairly certain I have nothing you would care to learn. I'm a teacher with a cause in my heart and men to lead. These poor men. Their leader has no real knowledge of warfare or tactics. I'm only a stubborn man, Ponder. That's my greatest advantage in this fight. I have deep within me the inability to do nothing. I may die today, but I will not die with a bullet in my back. I will not die in retreat. I am at least like the Apostle Paul, who wrote, 'This one thing I do, I press toward the mark.'" "Do you have anything written that you're to give me?" David asked. For a moment, David could see that Chamberlain did not understand his question. Then recognition flared in his eyes. "Yes," he said, "I do. I'd almost forgotten." Digging into his pocket, he pulled out a small tobacco pouch. The pouch was hand-sized, navy blue, with crossed swords, the symbol of a fighting man embroidered on the flap. It had been sewn from stout cloth, but the rough treatment it had received had worn the pouch to moleskin softness. The two gold buttons that closed the flap were metal, engraved with the image of an eagle. The tobacco pouch was beaten and threadbare, but it was still handsome, regal in a sense, the possession of an officer. Chamberlain opened the pouch and extracted a small, folded piece of paper. "I wrote this more than 2 months ago," he said. "We've had no tobacco for longer than that, so I slipped it in here for safekeeping." Passing the paper to David, he said, "I'm a little foggy on what I actually wrote. I woke up in the middle of the night after one of those dreams. The words you have there were rumbling around in my head as plain as day. I lit the lamp, found an inkwell, and put them to paper. I knew they were for you." "Thanks," David said as he held the paper in his hand. "My pleasure," Chamberlain replied. "This has all been a very curious situation. By the way, how do you get out of here?" David held up the paper. "All I have to do is read this," he snapped his fingers, "and I'm gone." Chamberlain looked around him. Noticing his brother Tom and several other men approaching, he put his hand on David's shoulder, squeezed it, and said, "If that's all you have to do, then, brother, you might want to read it now." He turned to go, then turned back to David. Still in his hand was the small tobacco pouch. Holding it out, he offered it to David. "I'll not be getting any more tobacco anyway," Chamberlain said. Wordlessly, David took the gift and watched the colonel walk away. Alone for a moment, everything in him wanted to take Chamberlain's advice. "Read the paper now," he told himself. "Get out of here." But something kept nudging him to stay, to watch. Placing the precious piece of paper back into the tobacco pouch, David shoved the whole thing in his jeans pocket and eased up to the group of men surrounding Colonel Chamberlain. Sergeant Tozier was there, the hard-nosed old soldier who carried the battle flag. Tozier had a thick wad of torn cloth stuck into a hole in his shoulder where he had been wounded earlier.
"No help from the 83rd, he growled. "They're shot to ribbons. All they can do is extend the line a bit. We're getting murdered on our flank."
"Can we extend?" Chamberlain asked. "There's nothing to extend, Joshua," his brother Tom answered. "Over half our men are down."
"How are we for ammunition?"
"We've been shooting a lot."
"I know we've been shooting a lot. I want to know how we're holding out."
"I'll check."
As Tom moved off, a voice came from a young soldier who had climbed a tree.
"They're forming again, Colonel."
Chamberlain looked up to see the boy pointing downhill.
"They're forming up right now," he said. "And they've been reinforced. There's more of them this time."
"Sir," Sergeant Rule Thomas, out of breath, stumbled into their midst. "Colonel Chamberlain, sir. Colonel Vincent is dead."
"Are you sure, Sergeant?"
"Yes, sir. He was shot right at the first of the fight. We were firmed up by Weed's brigade in the front, but now Weed's dead. They moved Hazlett's battery up top. Hazlett's dead, too."
Tom came running back.
"Joshua," he said, "we're out. 1-2 rounds per man at the most. Some of the men have nothing at all."
Chamberlain turned to a thin man standing to his right. It was First Sergeant Ellis Spear.
"Spear," he said calmly, "tell the boys to take the ammunition from the wounded and the dead."
"Maybe we should think about pulling out, sir,"
Spear said cautiously.
"We will not be pulling out, Sergeant," Chamberlain replied grimly. "Carry out my orders, please."
"Colonel,"
Tozier spoke up.
"Sir, we won't hold them again. You know we won't."
"Joshua,"
it was Tom speaking.
"Here they come."
David had been listening to the exchange between the officers, fascinated by the horror of their situation. But when he heard the rebel yells coursing up through the trees once more, his blood turned icy cold. "I've waited too late to read the paper," he thought. "I'll never get out of here now." As he grabbed for the tobacco pouch, a calm washed over him with that same familiar urging. Wait. Watch. Listen. Learn. Chamberlain was standing in full view, on top of the wall, his arms crossed, staring down at the advancing enemy. Sergeant Spear had returned and was standing at his colonel's feet. Tozier, Tom, and another lieutenant, a boy named Melcher, were also bunched below. David stood several feet behind the group.
"Joshua," Tom sounded, "give an order."
Chamberlain remained stoic. Deep in thought, he was quickly sorting the situation.
"We can't retreat," he said to himself. "We can't stay here. When I am faced with the choice of doing nothing or doing something, I will always choose to act. I am a person of action."
Turning his back to the rebels, he looked down at his men.
"Fix bayonets,"
he said. At first, no one moved. They simply stared at him with open mouths.
"We'll have the advantage of moving downhill," Chamberlain said. "Fix bayonets now. Execute a great right wheel of the entire regiment. Swing the left first."
Lieutenant Melcher spoke up. He was confused.
"Sir," he asked, "what's a great right wheel?"
But the colonel had already jumped from the rocks.
Tozier answered the question. "He means to charge, son. A great right wheel is an all-out charge."
David watched in awe as Chamberlain drew his sword, leaped up under the wall again and screamed, "Bayonets! Bayonets!" Turning, the colonel pointed the sword directly at David and slightly bowed his head. Then he wheeled to face the overwhelming odds and slashed his blade through the air. With a power born of righteousness and fear, the schoolteacher from Maine roared, "Charge! Charge! Charge!" to his men, and they did. Tumbling over the wall, the men who were left rose their voices to meet the voice of their leader. "Charge!" they cried. "Charge! Charge!" David rushed to the wall, looking downhill. He was stunned to see the advancing Confederate force stop in its tracks. Almost immediately, the soldiers turned and ran. A few of the braver souls emptied their rifles before dropping them to follow the rest. About 70 yards down the slope, David caught sight of Chamberlain. He had his left hand on the trunk of a tree, and in his right he held the sword, the point of which was resting on the collarbone of a rebel officer. The man had his hands up. It was over. David climbed over the rocks and sat down. With his back to the wall, he pulled the pouch from his pocket. As he looked down the slope, David brushed his fingers over the silky smoothness of the material. He put it close to his face and smelled the mixture of earth, sweat, and old tobacco. Unbuttoning the flap, David removed the paper that Chamberlain had written. With a final glance downhill and a deep breath, David opened the page. The third decision for success. I am a person of action. Beginning today, I will create a new future by creating a new me. No longer will I dwell in a pit of despair, moaning over squandered time and lost opportunity. I can do nothing about the past. My future is immediate. I will grasp it in both hands and carry it with running feet. When I am faced with the choice of doing nothing or doing something, I will always choose to act. I seize this moment. I choose now. I am a person of action. I am energetic. I move quickly. Knowing that laziness is a sin, I will create a habit of lively behavior. I will walk with a spring in my step and a smile on my face. The lifeblood rushing through my veins is urging me upward and forward into activity and accomplishment. Wealth and prosperity hide from the sluggard, but rich rewards come to the person who moves quickly. I am a person of action. I inspire others with my activity. I am a leader. Leading is doing. To lead, I must move forward. Many people move out of the way for a person on the run. Others are caught up in his wake. My activity will create a wave of success for the people who follow. My activity will be consistent. This will instill confidence in my leadership. As a leader, I have the ability to encourage and inspire others to greatness. It is true. An army of sheep led by a lion would defeat an army of lions led by a sheep. I am a person of action. I can make a decision. I can make it now. A person who moves neither left nor right is destined for mediocrity. When faced with a decision, many people say they are waiting for God, but I understand in most cases, God is waiting for me. He has given me a healthy mind to gather and sort information and the courage to come to a conclusion. I am not a quivering dog, indecisive and fearful. My constitution is strong and my pathway clear. Successful people make their decisions quickly and change their minds slowly. Failures make their decisions slowly and change their minds quickly. My decisions come quickly and they lead to victory. I am a person of action. I am daring. I am courageous. Fear no longer has a place in my life. For too long, fear has outweighed my desire to make things better for my family. Never again. I have exposed fear as a vapor, an imposter that never had any power over me in the first place. I do not fear opinion, gossip, or the idle chatter of monkeys, for all are the same to me. I do not fear failure, for in my life, failure is a myth. Failure exists only for the person who quits, and I do not quit. I am courageous. I am a leader. I seize this moment. I choose now. I am a person of action. Chapter 6. The nausea was more pronounced this time. When the rock wall disappeared behind David's back, he immediately felt a swaying sensation drawing him down, back up, and then down again. Balling his fists and ducking his head, David wondered when the time shift would be finished. The sick feeling was almost overwhelming. Carefully, David opened his eyes and understood. The movement he had felt was not part of the travel. He had arrived in less than an instant. He was on a boat. It was dark, but despite the darkness, David could see the water in starlight. It was the ocean, he knew, for the salty smell reminded him of vacations to the beach with Ellen and Jenny. The motion of the boat bothered him less as his vision adjusted to his surroundings. Feeling around him, David discovered that he was sitting on a large pile of coiled rope. At least he thought it was rope. It was rougher and less uniform than any rope he'd ever used. It felt as if it were made out of grass. Touching the rope reminded David that he still held Chamberlain's paper in one hand and the tobacco pouch in the other. Excited and somewhat amazed that the pouch had come with him, David hurriedly placed the paper in the pouch and buttoned it. Then he remembered the page from Truman and King Solomon's leather scroll. Removing them from his pocket, David placed the first two priceless writings inside the colonel's tobacco pouch with the third and shoved it back into the pocket of his jeans. Gingerly, David rose from his place of arrival. He was stiff and somewhat sore, as if he'd been still for a long time. Looking up, David saw a massive broadcloth, a sail, and smiled. He had sailed with his father as a child. Small lakes and small boats, nothing this size. Dad would really get a kick out of this, he said aloud. Then David frowned. Where are you, Dad? He whispered. Suddenly, David felt very alone and very tired. Sinking down onto the pile of rope, he lay his head back as the tears welled up in his eyes. Would he ever see Ellen again? Or his daughter? Sweet Jenny. What were they thinking now? Were they scared? Happy? Had 10 minutes passed? Or 100 years?
My friend! Psst! My friend!
David felt a tugging on his sleeve and opened his eyes. It was still dark, though he felt as if he'd been asleep for some time.
My friend! A figure hissed urgently. Please, if you will, come with me.
After being practically jerked to his feet, David followed the outline of a small, stocky man as he lightly stepped around barrels and ropes and poles, working his way to the center of the boat. Struggling to keep up, David almost tripped several times until, finally, the man stopped at the base of the mast. It was a large pole, bigger around than David could have reached, rising up into the darkness. Supporting the mainsail, it was covered in ropes and buckles. Without a glance at David, the man said simply, "Up!" and motioned with his hand for David to follow. The man was almost out of sight in seconds, so quickly did he climb. David hurried to keep up, but it was like crawling through a spider's web. In only a short time, however, he felt a hand grasp the back of his shirt. The small man was very strong. He heaved David up, over the lip, and into a wooden cup built around the top of the mast. They were in the crow's nest. The man smoothed David's shirt where he had grabbed it, then placed both hands on David's shoulders.
"Welcome, welcome, my friend," he said quietly, but with enthusiasm. "I am most honored to make your acquaintance. And your name is..."
"My name is David. David Ponder."
"Ah, Senior Ponder. May I call you David?"
"Yes, of course."
"Excellent. Are you hungry?"
"No, not really. I..."
"Good, good. We have very little to eat, and what we do have contains wee bugs."
David flinched.
"But there is no problem," the man said. "You will see. Our journey is almost at an end."
Despite the darkness, a reflection of the stars from the water illuminated the crow's nest in a soft glow. David could see the man clearly now. He had reddish-brown hair, very curly, that fell almost to his shoulders. A triangular green felt hat was set far back on his head, the forward point jutting toward the sky. The rest of his clothes, but for a stout canvas jacket, were in tatters. The man's pants fell in strips around his ankles, and his shoes were virtually non-existent, hard leather wrapped around his feet.
"May I ask your name, sir?" David asked. "Why, yes, yes, of course."
The man put a hand to his head.
"How rude of me. I am Capitan Colon. Captain Cristobal Colon, master of the Santa Maria, at your service."
He gave a little bow.
"Colon?" David asked. "Columbus? You are Christopher Columbus?"
"Yes." The man smiled a bit confused.
"Columbus is the English pronunciation of my name, but your Portuguese is flawless. I naturally assumed..."
David grinned. "I'm speaking Portuguese tonight only." Columbus tilted his head as if trying to understand what David thought was humorous.
"I see,"
he said, though it was obvious to David that he did not. Clapping his hands together and rubbing them vigorously, Columbus changed the subject.
"Well, whatever it is that you're doing tonight, the night itself will soon be over. The sun will join us shortly."
The rocking of the vessel was more pronounced in the high perch, but otherwise David felt safe, almost comfortable. From this elevation he could see below that the boat was not very large compared to the vastness of the sea in which it sailed. Less than 200 feet in length, the Santa Maria creaked and groaned with the rolling of the gentle waves. Looking behind her, David could just make out the shadows of two other boats. They rode the swells about 100 yards to the rear, flanking their leader on either side.
"The Nina and the Pinta?" David asked.
"Why, yes," Columbus answered.
"Seaworthy vessels both, though not quite so luxurious as this."
He flung his arms out below him, indicating the deck of the Santa Maria. David suppressed a smile.
"Do you know where you are?"
he asked.
"Certainly," Columbus smiled. "I am right here. Do you know where you are?"
David glanced around.
The Atlantic?
Good, good, Columbus said as he clapped David on the back.
You are a wonderful navigator.
David was somewhat confused and more than a little uneasy. He spoke up again.
Do you really not know where you are? He asked.
Does that have any bearing on what I can accomplish? Columbus asked in return.
I don't quite understand, David said.
I have heard that question in one form or another since I was a child, Columbus began. Do you know where you are? Do you know what you are? Colon, you are uneducated. Colon, you are poor. You are the son of a weaver. What do you know about the sea?
He shook his head in disgust.
Do you know where you are? Is a question that affects me not in the least. Now, do you know where you are going? There is a question I can answer, so ask me that.
Excuse me? Ask you?
Ask me, do you know where you are going? Ask me!
Okay, David shrugged. Do you know where you are going?
For the few minutes the two men had been in the crow's nest, they had conversed in rather measured tones. At that point, however, Columbus received the question for which he had been waiting. He boomed out the answer. Carrying across the water, it sounded like the voice of God. Throwing his hand forward, pointing into the western sky, he cried, "Yes! Yes! I know where I am going! I am going to a new world!" Shivers played up David's spine as he watched the explorer point into the darkness. For a moment, neither man said a word. Clearing his throat, David broke the silence. "How long since you left Spain?" he asked.
64 days, Columbus said as he lowered his arm, and today we shall see land. Look behind us.
David turned and saw brightening in the eastern sky. Dawn will be breaking soon.
When it does, directly in front of the Santa Maria, you will see land. Beautiful land with trees and fruit and animals and people who will welcome us as heroes. The water gushing from the ground will be cold and pure. It will sparkle as if sprinkled with diamonds. This will be a place for men's dreams to come true. A glorious new world claimed by Cristobal Colón in the name of King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella.
David leaned forward and put his hands on the lip of the crow's nest. That would be King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella of Spain, correct? He asked. Columbus nodded.
They are the financiers of this expedition. King John of Portugal, my king, said no to this grand opportunity, as did the kings and queens of many other countries. 19 years, my friend. It took 19 years to find sponsorship. For 19 years, I endured the agony of public humiliation for my convictions.
Which convictions? David asked.
The conviction, Columbus said, his voice rising, no, the absolute certainty that I can establish a new trade route by sailing west. West!
Columbus grabbed David by the shoulders and shook him once as he said, my friend, the world is a sphere. It is not flat. We are sailing around the earth on the smooth surface of a sphere. We will not fall off some imaginary edge. Are you the only person who believes this? David asked.
At the moment, yes, Columbus said, but that bothers me not in the least. Truth is truth. If 1,000 people believe something foolish, it is still foolish.
Truth is never dependent upon consensus of opinion. I have found it is better to be alone and acting upon the truth in my heart than to follow a gaggle of silly geese doomed to mediocrity.
You say it doesn't bother you in the least, David said. You don't care that people think you are, well, crazy?
My friend, Columbus said with a smile, if you worry about what other people think of you, then you will have more confidence in their opinion than you have in your own. Poor is the man whose future depends upon the opinions and permission of others. Remember this, if you are afraid of criticism, you will die doing nothing.
David frowned. But with so many people against you, he asked, how did you get started in the first place?
Getting started, getting finished, both ends of a journey require a demonstration of passion, Columbus mused.
David stared blankly at the great man. Passion, he said again in a forceful whisper. Passion is the product of the heart. Passion is what helps you when you have a great dream. Passion breeds conviction and turns mediocrity into excellence. Your passion will motivate others to join you in pursuit of your dream.
With passion, you will overcome insurmountable obstacles. You will become unstoppable.
David began to ask another question, but Columbus put his hand out to silence him.
Please, my friend, he said, quiet for a time.
David did as he asked, and followed his gaze into the western sky. The sun was just breaking the horizon behind them, throwing a brilliance over the miles of open ocean. Columbus peered ahead, concentrating with all his might into the distance. For one full minute, he did not move. For 2 minutes, then 10. Only his eyes shifted as he scanned the line where the water touched the sky. After almost half an hour, Columbus straightened his back and rubbed his eyes. Nothing? David asked softly.
Yes, something, Columbus answered.
What? David looked around, confused.
You see land?
Yes,
the great man said simply. David frowned. He was still straining to catch a glimpse of what Columbus claimed he saw.
Point it out to me, please.
Señor Ponder, Columbus said, you are looking in the wrong direction. Today you will not see land off the bow of my ship. You will see land only by looking into my eyes.
David turned. He felt as if he'd been tricked.
So there's no land? He said indignantly. Yes, there is land,
Columbus replied. And it is right there. He gestured past the bow of the ship again. I see it as plainly as I see you. For almost 20 years I have seen it, and tomorrow you will see it too. It will come into view just as dawn breaks, directly in front of the Santa Maria, beautiful land, with trees and fruit and animals and people who will welcome us as heroes. The water gushing from the ground will be cold and pure. It will sparkle as if sprinkled with diamonds. This will be a place for men's dreams to come true. A glorious new world claimed by Cristobal Colón in the name of King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella.
For a brief time, David did not breathe. His hair rustled in the steady breeze as he looked deeply into the eyes of the man before him. He saw there the passion and belief that had fueled this voyage of destiny. What could I accomplish, David wondered, with a spirit as powerful as this?
El Capitan!
David blinked. The spell had been broken by a voice calling from below.
El Capitan, sir!
The two men peered over the edge of the crow's nest. Directly underneath them were 4 men. They motioned for Columbus to join them. Columbus pursed his lips and sighed. Trouble? David asked. Swinging his leg over the lip of the wooden cup, Columbus answered,
Most assuredly, these are my officers.
David climbed through the rigging, trying his best to follow the agile descent of the seamen. When at last he reached the deck of the Santa Maria, voices were already being raised. The first officer, though dressed exactly like his captain, was tall and heavily muscled. His long black hair had been tied into a ponytail and laid over his shoulder so that it fell down the front of his shirt. Like the other 3 men, he was clean-shaven. Leading the contingent against their leader, First Officer Juan Garcon did all the talking.
Your officers are in agreement, El Capitan. This voyage is finished. It is time to return.
Columbus looked at the men and said,
But we are almost there. The hardest part of the journey is past. Tomorrow you will see land. It will be beautiful land with trees and fruit. Enough! Juan Garcon cried. We have heard this sad refrain for too many weeks, sir. Surely you must see that the men have reached their limit.
Columbus smiled stiffly.
I see men who don't know the limits they can reach.
Juan Garcon briefly closed his eyes as if to contain himself.
Sir, your officers and I have decided to turn back. We are at an end.
Garcon and the other men moved to go, but were brought up short by the booming voice of their captain.
Gentlemen!
Columbus shouted.
The officers stopped and faced him. Gentlemen! He said with less volume this time. Might I remind you that we have less than 10 days of food and water left in our stores? To reverse course is the gambit of a fool. It not only means failure, but certain death as well. In God's name, men, I ask you to think. We are at sea now for 64 days. To which port do you return? Our only course is forward. Our only hope is to press on.
The men stood with their heads down. They seemed not only outmaneuvered, but beaten. Garcon spoke again, softly this time.
Is this realistic, Capitan? Will we find land?
Columbus moved to put his arm around the shoulders of the taller man.
Is this realistic, Garcon? I say to you, no. But then nothing great was ever accomplished by a realistic person. Will we find land? Yes, yes! We will find land, but that will be the least of your discoveries.
Columbus pointed to his first officer's chest.
You will find a heart for success that you did not know existed. You will find a Juan Garcon who is able to lead men to new worlds of their own. You will find greatness.
Garcon straightened and breathed deeply.
Forgive my insolence, El Capitan.
Forgotten, Columbus said as he made a dismissing motion with his hand. Go, Juan Garcon, lead your men, and believe. As the officers left, Columbus moved once more toward the crow's nest. David followed him up, finding it easier this time because of the daylight. Again, however, Columbus pulled David into the cup by the back of his shirt. Catching his breath, David watched Columbus settle his back against the mast and fix his gaze again upon the western horizon. "May I ask a question?" David said quietly.
"Certainly," Columbus replied.
"What did you mean down below when you told your officer that he would find a heart for success?" Columbus inhaled and slowly blew out his breath before answering.
"Most people fail at whatever they attempt because of an undecided heart. Should I? Should I not? Go forward, go back. Success requires the emotional balance of a committed heart. When confronted with a challenge, the committed heart will search for a solution. The undecided heart searches for an escape."
Columbus cleared his throat, coughing gently, then continued.
"A committed heart does not wait for conditions to be exactly right. Why? Because conditions are never exactly right. Indecision limits the Almighty and His ability to perform miracles in your life. He has put the vision in you. Proceed! To wait, to wonder, to doubt, to be indecisive is to disobey God."
Without taking his eyes off the water, Columbus reached under his jacket and removed a parchment. "For you," he said simply. Unfolding it, he handed it to David. David took the yellowed paper, glanced at it briefly, and said, "You will find your new world." Columbus, eyes still straight ahead, spoke quietly.
"I know."
David smiled and shook his head in wonder. "How do you know?" he asked. Columbus turned and looked at David.
"I have a decided heart," he said, and turned back.
For a moment, David said nothing. He felt the purest sense of awe for this man who knew nothing, yet seemed to know everything. He opened his mouth to speak again.
"But how, Senor Ponder?"
Columbus interrupted. He placed his arm over David's shoulders.
"It is time for you to read the message I was given for you. Study it carefully, for it is within these words that you will find a heart for success that you did not know existed. You will find a David Ponder who is able to lead men to new worlds of their own. You will find greatness."
And with those words, the great explorer, Christopher Columbus, hugged David and kissed him on each cheek.
"Read," he said again and smiled. "I am very busy."
David watched him ease to the edge of the crow's nest, put his elbows on the lip, and looked to the west once more. The wind shifted and rattled the parchment in his hand. Sitting down, David propped his back against the wall of the cup and braced his feet on the mast. Stealing one last glance at the man who had penned the words, he read, "The fourth decision for success. I have a decided heart." A wise man once said, a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. Knowing this to be true, I am taking my first step today. For too long, my feet have been tentative, shuffling left and right, more backward than forward.